And that goes for those of you who were here yesterday and those of you who weren't here yesterday. That what I did is say that my own personal beliefs, as opposed to the beliefs that I've studied in classes in school, about the nature of man is, and then we sort of talked about that last hour, is that he is basically, and in fact essentially, and this really is all there is to him, is that he is a social, imaginative animal. And if we understand the definition of these three words, social, imaginative, and animal, we understand exactly what the essential difference is between man and the rest of creation. And I made some comments yesterday, and I want to sort of summarize this. I tried to explain yesterday a little bit of what was meant by social. And I said this means that he has a need for love, that the reason man is social, or the reason he has a need for love, is because he is social, and our social nature is really fulfilled through love. And I tried to define this, and I said that in my definition, love is the attraction in a person towards goodness. That if I love you, I'm attracted to you because there's goodness in you. And we went into some detail about the nature of this, and that essentially is what it meant, or what I tried to explain. Let me give you some other examples now of how this can be communicated, and sort of illustrations that show that it is necessary. Some of these have been done with animals. I mentioned some of these experiments yesterday, so I'll mention different ones today. One of them is an experiment done by a man named Liddell with twin goats. Goats apparently usually have twins. And he reared one of these goats, he reared these goats exactly alike, except for 25 minutes each day. He took one goat away from the mother and placed it in an exactly similar environment to the one that was with the mother, a dark room. So he turned the lights out. And the goat with the mother had absolutely no adverse reaction, aside from a first little startle kind of moment, and then he snuggles up against his mother. The goat that was left away from the mother in the majority of instances died because it became so anxious alone that it was unable to eat later on. It apparently secreted so much adrenaline that the stomach could no longer digest food, and it became too nervous to eat, so it died of malnutrition because of this feeling of aloneness, separation from the mother when a frustrating event occurs. There are experiments that have been done. A woman named Margaret Ribble, for instance, did experiments with babies, human babies, in a nursing home, and found that when these babies were separated from their mother or from attention, the nurses being very busy, for a long period of time, they developed what she called marasmus. Their muscles would start to become rigid, their eyes would sort of glaze over. It'd be very much like we talked yesterday. Didn't we talk yesterday about anaphytic depression, or did I mention that? Renee Spitz. Well, anyhow, it was a very bad kind of a symptomatology that the baby was exhibiting. And this, in every case, 100% of the time, was relieved by some wet nurse, not the child's original mother. In some cases, it was the original mother, picking the baby up and nursing him, breastfeeding him. This is a baby under age 1 year. There's another experiment done by two people, Steels and Dye, that show that they took a group of orphans from a very crowded orphanage institution where they received a minimum amount of care. All their physical needs were met, but not very many psychological needs. The average IQ of the people in this orphanage was in the below normal range, around 80, 82, 85, something like that. They took these babies and placed them in a home for mentally retarded girls, teenage girls. Now these girls, because they're mentally retarded, aren't going to give very much intellectual stimulation. But they did give these kids lots of love. Their allowances they spent buying candy and toys, and spent a lot of time with these kids. And then they did this study, and they found that at the end of 9 months' time, these kids who were brought to the home for retarded girls had an average IQ improvement of 27 points. They were now in the normal range of IQ. But those kids, and these were selected at random, the kids that were left in the institution, their IQs deteriorated instead of improved. Which indicates, you see, that love, that human beings are social animals, that the more love they receive, the more mentally healthy, and even the more physically healthy they become. And we talked about physical health yesterday. And this is, I'm saying this just in way of summary about the social nature of man. I want today to talk about a different part of this definition, his imaginative nature, that this essentially makes man, and I'm glad Kent, wherever he's gone now, asked this question about whether there is anything original in man. Because according to my definition, there really would not be, except as it comes in through his senses, that it's really a quality of the imagination that oftentimes other people have called his rational ability. For instance, as Paul said, Aristotle talks about man, his ability to originate new thoughts. Is really, I believe, and this, again, let me make this clear, what I'm talking about yesterday and today are entirely my personal views. I'm doing this just to help myself really formulate them as much as any other reason. And there's a lot of controversy about this among not only psychologists, but also philosophers and theologians. But maybe what will happen is some of you know about the viewpoints of these other philosophers or psychologists or theologians, and we'll have a little bit of an argument when I finish talking. What I'm saying is this, that and yesterday I made this thesis statement, and I want to support it somewhat today, only in various ways. That because man is a social animal, he has a need for a constant presence of love. It is my belief that his imagination supplies this by knowing through his imagination the presence of God. Now, the question was asked me yesterday after the lecture that I apparently didn't make clear. If I'm talking about this, does this mean that if we know of God through the use of our imagination, does that mean that there is no God? No, it does not. I mentioned certain things that I could imagine, like Hawaii, where I've never been there, and I imagine it through the material that comes from my senses, and I imagine that it's there, and other people go there, and they see through senses other than their imagination that there is a Hawaii. And I think the same is sort of true of God. We know of him through our imagination, but there really is a God. Again, the question was asked, well, what about this? I mean, are you really imagining something if you say in your mind this might not be so? Paul, you asked this question, and you rephrase it. Paul Fanning, if I phrase it incorrectly, you correct me until I get this sort of point of view. That is it really possible for somebody to imagine something that he doesn't really think exists, or isn't your, whatever you know through your imagination somehow correct, I think? And you mentioned, I forget what you mentioned, but let me at least answer what I think to be the question, and you can re-ask it. That, let me give this illustration. I think it is possible for one person, for instance, to imagine God as an angry, revengeful God, a God really without love, but that arbitrarily makes people a certain way and manipulates them. In this person's imagination, that's what God is. And another person in his imagination believes that God is a loving God, a God that has ultimate concern for mankind and is with him always. And these two points of view of God are different. And therefore, one of these people's imagination would be less the truth than the other one's. Does this sort of answer the question you raised about what I believe? That it is possible to imagine things as they are not. That we have things in our imagination that have no real existence. And we sort of talked to you and I about Plato's doctrine of idea forms.
I see what you're driving at. Of course, your example probably not the most fortunate, because you have illustrated the correctness of honest imagination in that you have used as your examples two qualities of God that are very real, both the wrath and the love.
But see, I'm saying in one person's imagination, he excludes the other quality. He imagines one quality, but not
that
the other.
That would be incomplete imagination.
Well, that's what you're saying.
Direct imagination.
Well, how about if we imagine, take this thing, that a person imagines God to have four heads and 3 feet and is blue and pink, polka-dotted, and lives in the middle of a volcano.
Well, this will come back to the original point that we discussed. I would consider this not to be a genuine imagination, to be a false imagination. You wouldn't really be imagining this. You would just, it would be a dishonest type of imagination, attempt to...
Well, let's not make the example so ridiculous then, but let's say we take the example of a primitive tribe that believes their God is a sun god, that God is a sun. How would you say this is a false imagination, or are they really imagining this?
Might depend on the qualities they attribute to the sun god. If they were just imagining a different name for the single god of the universe.
What you're really saying, though, and I disagree with this, is that everything a person in good faith imagines is really true.
I offered a little hypothesis, where you can either accept or refute it.
Well, I do both. I objectively refute it, but think so. And we talked to the camping lord at our house last night. We were having a discussion about this. If I hypnotize you, and I tell you, see, and everybody in this room is present, you know, and I get you in this hypnotic state, and I tell you there is an ant crawling up your arm, and you're in this state of a trance-like state, and you swat away at your arm, and you react, or maybe I see a bumblebee, you know, probably more obvious that you probably wouldn't like this, or something that you dislike, whatever insect you wouldn't like to have on your arm. And I see you react to it. Now, subjectively for you, you're imagining an ant on your arm, and there's a real truth of an ant being on your arm. No question about it, for you. For you, that ant is there. See, I have seen this happen. And there is just absolutely no doubt that the subjective truth of this for you is that an ant is on your arm. And yet everybody else in this room says, yes, but aha, objectively there is no ant on this person's arm. Now, who is right? See, they're both right.
I suppose my rejoinder to this would be a very weak one. It would possibly be that you have rendered ineffective normal honesty of my imagination by your power of hypnosis.
Well, I'm saying really that a lot of what a person imagines really comes this way, through the suggestive power of the culture. There are cultures, you'll grant this, that believe in different kinds of gods. Let's say, take the Greeks, for instance, you know, they believed in Zeus and Athena and Aphrodite, and they had all these gods, and we don't. Now, don't you think that...
I think you refuse me sufficiently.
You know, it's really a danger, it's really a bad, terrible thing for a person to do, to have an hour given to him and pick on people and say, no.
I don't feel I'm being picked on. I just feel that our private conversations are not of great general interest.
Okay. But I did want to sort of clarify what I am saying so I'm not be misunderstood.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. Now, I have lots and lots of other experiments here to talk about the social nature of man, and I'm going to skip over to get at this imaginative quality. I think that man, there's something else that's inherent in the imaginative quality of man that makes him different from animal. And that is that his imagination oftentimes works in a way that is symbolic rather than a literal representation. For instance, I can imagine something like Hawaii, and that's a literal representation. There's nothing symbolic about it. I see the image in my mind of this sand beach and people in the water in this great big hotel. I forget the name of it now, but you know these pictures I've seen, and I supply this with my imagination, what the temperature must be like, and things like this. And that's a literal kind of representation, and it's not really symbolic, I don't believe. But there is a sense that human beings, through their imagination, also become very symbolic. In fact, I think that some of the deepest truths of human nature are represented symbolically. And I want to give just one example, which is an example that was told to me. And I want to discuss this, and then I want to go into other truths that I believe can be found in the same kind of symbolism, the truths about the nature of human beings. This is a very pretty girl who came to talk to me. My wife sometimes gets a little disturbed about these pretty girls that come to see me and we spend hours, and I tell the secretary, don't ring my phone, you know, don't buzz me when the call comes in because I'm busy. And sometimes I come home at night and my wife asks me what's going on. But this time it was a very pretty girl, 19-year-old, very beautiful girl who came to talk to me. And her problem objectively was this. She was flunking out of school. She'd been caught drunk in the dormitory. She was having sexual relationships with not only one boy, and she sometimes was afraid she was pregnant. She felt her life was deteriorating. Very objectively unhappy girl. And I asked her what she thought was the cause of this, if we could talk a little bit about her life situation to determine whether there wasn't something we could discover and therefore, you know, work with to make her more happy. And she said, no, everything is fine. And I'm sort of, in some ways, a believer of some of the things that Freud said. And one of the things he says is that sometimes the important people around you are those that will cause these kinds of problems, especially a mother, father, or a family situation, one that may lead to early childhood, but even right now may remind you. And so anyhow, I asked her about her relationship with her family. And she told me objectively this. She said, it's wonderful. That's the one thing I'm really, really happy about is my mother and father love me so much. They give me anything I want. Anything I ask for, they give me. I have new clothes. I have lots of money. I went to a private high school. We take trips around the world every so often. I have everything a girl could want in my family. It's something else, but I don't know what. Well, then she started talking. She says, you know, one thing that I think somehow is relevant is this dream I keep having. It reoccurs over and over again in just little different details. And so I said, okay, let's talk about your dream. You know, psychologists somehow are supposed to talk about dreams anyhow, and I only think I have four times in my short career as a psychologist, but this is one of the times. I said, okay, we'll talk about your dream. And this is a dream she had. She was alone in her bedroom at the end of a long corridor, a very long corridor of many doors, and here she was at the end of it in her bedroom. And she was afraid in there for some reason, and when in came her mother. Now, her mother looked like this. Her mother was pale, and she said, sort of like, you know, in the Bible, like a whitened sepulcher. That's the way her mother looked. Or maybe like a skeleton. There was something about this nature of her mother. And her mother was carrying a large bag, and in this bag were many, many things. There was a big wad of money, there were lots of clothes, and there were jewelry, and silverware also, she mentioned. And the mother propped this girl's mouth wide open and began to stuff these things down her throat. And as she was beginning to suffocate, gasping for air, in came her father. And the father was weighted down by one very large, heavy object. It was a large set of car keys. And he was just bent under the weight of these, dragging them in, and then he stuffed these down his daughter's throat. And just as she was blacking out in terror and dying, in came a boyfriend who opened up a large hole in her, let the air in so she could breathe, and she came back to life. And then she woke up sweating and very much afraid. This happened in her dream over and over again. Now what I'm saying is that there's much symbolism in this dream that can be interpreted by a person who understands something about this symbolism. And that this symbolism is saying a very definite truth about the nature of this girl, about her innermost nature. You see that she is imaginative and using symbolism in her imagination to convey a deep truth about her. Now, some of these truths are obvious. The fact, for instance, that her parents are stuffing all these things down her throat, well, I think almost anybody here know what that means. She's resentful of the fact, and this came out subsequently in talking with her, the hostility began to really pour out from her, that her parents never spent any time with her. What she wanted is for them to give her their physical presence, and instead they gave her presents, you know, like you did at Christmas time. And she hated that. She didn't want the whole emphasis of this social relationship to be dependent on objects, but instead on this kind of a physical relationship. There are many other things, though, in this dream aside from that, which is a very important one that I may return to yet in these lectures. She saw her mother as a whitened sepulcher and also as a skeleton. We didn't get into this too much when talking with her, but later on it came to me what this symbol really is. Two symbols. The whitened sepulcher refers in the Bible, remember, to what? To the Pharisees, who are hypocrites. You hypocrites, you whitened sepulchers. And somehow there was something hypocritical in her mind about the way her mother tried to show her love. You know, I love you, here's $100, I'm going away for the weekend, have a good time. You know, that this is sort of hypocritical. Now, I didn't discuss this with her, but I think it's there. Also, there were many symbols here of death. She was suffocating to death. She was at the end of a long corridor, and I think this symbolized for her that she's at the end of a long series of something. I'm doing this now retrospectively because I know what happened later. A few weeks later, she tried to commit suicide. She took a razor blade and slashed both of her wrists, and she didn't die. But I think that this is sort of telling us symbolically what is on her mind. Death. Her mother is a skeleton, another symbol of death. And I think many of these symbols here are telling things about her that are almost impossible for us to know objectively, because a human being is by nature so symbolic, so involved in his imagination about what the real truth of himself is. Now let me make this statement, support this statement with examples that I've already used in here in the last 2 weeks. And in a sense, I'm sort of starting over again now. There's been almost a whole turnover of everybody but staff. Let me tell you some of my belief is this, that those things in our culture which are very familiar to us almost always reveal to us deep symbolic truth. And I'm speaking of, especially now, of the common myths and story tales and these kind of things in our culture that sort of permeate we perpetuate them to our children. Every story I tell to my children, I think, has deep meaning. At least if it's a story that's been around for a long time, it's kind of a classical story. I don't really know which story to start out with. I guess the easiest ones first to kind of make my point. And Freud made this point for me in two of his books, Interpretation of Dreams and another one, Psychopathology of Everyday Life, where he pointed out very definitely the symbolic nature of man and the way that he is more symbolic than he is anything else in his innermost thoughts. Now, Freud, let me give you one example of something Freud interpreted this way, the story of Oedipus Rex, or Oedipus Tyrannus, you know, King Oedipus, by Sophocles, just one of the trilogy of the three stories. In this story, let me summarize the story briefly for you and then show you the way Oedipus interprets this. Oedipus is born deformed or handicapped, and in the Greek culture, this is about, what, 4th century BC or 5th century BC. This is the kind of thing that just isn't allowed to live. If it's a deformed child, their emphasis there was put on physical beauty and being able to get along, and a handicapped child is put out on the rocks to die. Well, Oedipus was put on the rocks to die. And I forget the story exactly now, if this was in Athens or if it was in Thebes, but these two cities are involved. I think it was Athens. So he's put out on the rocks in Athens, and a family on their way to Thebes sees him and adopts him and takes him along to Thebes where he is reared. When he's about 20 years old, the Delphi oracle tells him, Ed, I'm sorry about this, but you're going to kill your father and you're going to marry your mother. So in order to escape this terrible prophecy, he leaves Thebes and travels all the way to Athens to get away from his mother and father, so he doesn't know he's adopted. And on his way to Athens, he encounters his real father, King Cretan, is it? And he battles him and kills him, not knowing that it's his father, even knowing that it's a king, and kills this man. And he goes into Athens, and here Athens is in a terrible plight. The Sphinx has a riddle that if no one solves, the city will perish. And the riddle is this, what is it that walks on 4 feet in the morning and 2 feet in the afternoon and 3 feet on the evening? And here's Oedipus now, and he's a bright man, and he says, aha, see, this is a symbolic riddle even. The symbolism here is man, that he crawls on all fours and then he walks on 2 feet and then he uses a cane. See, this itself is symbolic. But Oedipus wins the $64,000 prize here because luckily, not only does he save Athens, but the queen has recently been widowed and he gets her for his wife by saving the city. So he marries his mother and he's killed his father and the oracle has come true and he discovers this and in shame he plucks out his eyes. And then in the next play wanders about the countryside with Antigone and see a blind beggar. Now, Freud says this story is a fine engrossing story, sure, but it's much more than that. It's symbolic of the real one of man's real deep down hang-ups, I guess you'd say, that every human being, and Freud works this into his theory, and I'll just explain this briefly, every human being has a desire to marry the parent of the opposite sex and sees the parent of the same sex as a rival. That little kids at age four might say, a little boy might say to his mother, Mommy, when I grow up, I'm going to marry you. I love you, Mommy. And when father comes home and puts his arm around the wife or something, the little boy will come and kick him away and want to sit on Mommy's lap. And this is something that's been noticed in families that are open to this kind of observation, and it's really true. There's a rivalry a lot of times at this age, four or five, between son and father, and the son's attracted to mother. And it's just the opposite for the girl. And Freud says this is the Oedipal complex, and it's a basic truth of man. Now, some psychologists disagree whether he's right or wrong. Many of them support this. Let me say what I think. That the story of Oedipus is not the only story that talks about the Oedipal complex. If Freud had never seen the story of Oedipus and had read Little Red Riding Hood, this would now be called the Little Red Riding Hood complex. Because it's the same story. Only the story of Little Red Riding Hood is much more symbolic than the story of Oedipus. It uses dream symbols instead of people figures. See, instead of using a real mother and father and son, it uses a wolf and a girl and grandmother. And a wolf is a dream symbol. And Freud pointed this out in both of these books that I mentioned. That a wolf, commonly in dreams, is a father. It has two aspects. It's a father figure. That's why boys around age four and five, see, a dog and a bear is too. So boys around age four and five are afraid of dogs very commonly. This is the most common phobia in a 4- and 5-year-old boy, is they're afraid of dogs. Girls will be afraid of the dark. I'm not going to bother now going into reasons why this is so, but it has to do with the Oedipal complex. That's why there are so many fairy tales about bears as well as about wolves and also about witches. A witch, you see, the mother takes on the connotation of a witch when the girl sees her as a rival, or as a fairy godmother when she sees her as good after the Oedipal complex is resolved. But let me get back to the story of Little Red Riding Hood then. If we accept Freud's hypothesis, and I accept this, that a wolf is a father figure, and it's a very different kind of a father figure. It's kind of a sexual father figure. Let me just make this one sentence, and I'll bet that everybody here in this room understands the hidden meaning behind this sentence. Now, assume that I'm talking to a girl who has just made an arrangement for a blind date, and I come to her and I say, your blind date is really a wolf, and what he's going to do is try to get you in the woods alone. Now, she has a suspicion that there's something hidden beneath my meaning, that really there's something. Now see, what I'm saying is that this symbolism is so close to the conscious mind that it's interpreted by everybody what I mean. Now notice the story of Little Red Riding Hood and compare it with the story of Oedipus. What happens? They both, see, let's assume that the story starts at the place where the Delphi oracle has prophesied you're going to kill your father and marry your mother. Only this is a girl now. And they go on a journey. What happens to Oedipus? He meets his father, right? Unknown to him. Here's a father figure that he doesn't know. What happens to Little Red Riding Hood? She meets a wolf in the woods. Now, she doesn't know what this is. And this part of the story is sort of insignificant. Nothing happens. She's just very temporarily waylaid, and then the wolf goes on. Now notice this now, what happens? Here's where the story really becomes the Oedipal complex, and it explains it from the girl's point of view instead of the man's, but the man's is in there too. If the wolf is a father figure, which we're assuming, Freud assumes this. So then the wolf is Little Red Riding Hood's father. Then who do you suppose Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother is? If we think this relationship out, it becomes the wolf's mother, right? We're making this assumption that you see a little girl has two sets of grandparents. One set of grandparents is the father's parents, the other set is the mother's parents. And we're assuming in this story that this is the father's parents, at least it makes it an Oedipal complex if we do it. Because what happens? The wolf then, or Little Red Riding Hood's father, goes to his mother's home. And it's sort of unusual in this particular story. I mean, a case could be made for it. But isn't it just a little unusual that the grandmother stays in bed when he knocks? She never gets out of bed. And what happens? The wolf comes in and jumps into bed with her and eats her up, right? Well, now, it doesn't take Freud to really interpret this as being a little risque, huh? A little bit risque. And that's the Oedipal complex, son and mother, this kind of physical attraction. Then what happens? See, I'm talking now about the older version of the story, or at least the one that I believe to be the older version, where the wolf eats up his mother, and then what happens? In comes his daughter. Daughter knocks at the door, and he seduces her into bed, doesn't he? I mean, he doesn't say, that's really what he does. He could get up out of bed, but he stays there and seduces her closer and closer, and she is somewhat fascinated and attracted by him. What beautiful white teeth, what beautiful ears, or whatever, however the story goes. And then what happens? He grabs Little Red Riding Hood into bed with him and eats her up. See, now here's the Oedipal complex both ways. The son has eaten his mother, we could say this a little bit more clearly instead of symbolically. Here's a son and mother relationship, and here's also a daughter-father relationship, right? This is incest, I mean, but it's an Oedipal complex, and Freud says this is at the basic root of all men. Then what happens? And this is very interesting how this ties in with other symbolic stories. A woodcutter comes along and cuts the wolf open, and what happens? You know, biologically this doesn't happen this way, but it happens in this story. Out come grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood. Now this is birth symbolism. And notice what's happened here. It's a father figure that's giving birth both to his daughter and to his mother. And this is a myth that's common in all cultures. In the Greek culture, it's Zeus that gives birth to Athena, a male giving birth to a female out of his head, springing full grown. See, that's the same symbolism as the father giving birth to the mother and to the daughter. In the story of Adam and Eve, it's Adam giving life to Eve, a male, you see, and the female springs out of him with the help of God, but it's really basically the same story. Even the story of creation is God the Father, not God the Mother giving birth to the world, but God the Father giving life to the world and to man, breathing on him. And I could go on with other cultures, that all cultures have this basic symbolism of the male. I've never yet met a man that's done this, really. But notice that this is the way the story goes. It's the male giving birth to the female. Always. Female springs full grown out of the male. Now there's lots of symbolism here, and it's been interpreted in different ways. One of the common interpretations is, and it's the one I guess that Plato taught, or maybe it's Camus. It's funny how he makes these very different people up. But I think Camus talks about this, it is the myth of Sisyphus, where he talks about the nature of man and woman, or that woman comes from man in all these symbols, and that signifies their attraction for each other, their desire for union. That constantly, you see, Eve is wanting to get back into Adam's rib, that they're one and the same substance. There's some male in every female and some female in every male, that they're alike, and their constant goal is for union. But I think there's something different here. That's the common explanation of these myths. And I think it's wrong, and I'm being a little bit more Freudian, I guess, in this interpretation, but because Freud had a very funny view of women. It's almost nasty to talk about the words he used about women, but he really said they're inferior to man, that they really belong to be man's helpmate. And I think here's the point that he's really getting at. I talked with a marriage counselor who also is I don't know how he got that position. He's a medical doctor who is not a psychiatrist, but his real practice is marriage counseling. And I have to ask him sometime how that happened. I never got into that, but that's what he does mostly. And he told me this, and I knew it from other sources, but he said it real well. He said, you know, there are so many marriages that are broken up just because people don't know the biological difference chemically between man and woman. He says woman is much more unstable than man, and let me give you some examples how male reacts very differently. And these examples are really true examples. I had talked with a boy at St. Olaf College, who a freshman who had been dating a girl for some 5 or 6 weeks, and he came out of the dorm to pick her up, and she came down, and she looked very pretty, and he said this to her. He said, "Do you look pretty tonight? Your hair is so pretty, and that's a pretty dress." And the girl smiled, and they had a wonderful evening. It was just fine. And 2 weeks later, this kind of thought came back to him, and he said the same thing. He said, "Do you look pretty tonight?" And she said, "I know I haven't had time to wash my hair today, and quit mocking me. It's the same old dirty dress I wore 2 weeks ago when you took me out." Now, don't mock me. See, this very different reaction. And the way this guy reacted to that is, my gosh, if I ever go out with another woman again, you know, somebody hit me. Because here's the same identical situation, and the female reacts to it differently. Or I've had the case of girls that come to me and say, "I don't know what's happened. My roommate and I got along so fine," and she'll start crying. "And today I walked in and she said, 'You dirty pig, you pick up your sweatshirt, it's been on the floor for 2 weeks.'" And then she'll say this. "Today it only has been on the floor for 2 weeks, but she never cared about it before." All of a sudden. See, it's all of a sudden that I'm a dirty pig. And it's that I've all of a sudden changed. Now, what's happening here? What's going on? Well, this doctor, and it's been explained by very interesting, and I think it's the truth of the situation, that what's going on here really has to do with the reproductive cycle, the menstrual cycle, that makes men and women different chemically. That a man doesn't have the same quantities of estrogen and, slip my mind now, this other one. No, that's the male one. Which one?
Progesterone?
Yes, progesterone. It's the male one, not androgen, but the other one. I keep getting these things chemically mixed up and not much of a chemist. But anyhow, the point is this, that especially women with highly developed nervous systems, and these are quite common on college campuses, the other ones don't always go to college. I'm not saying just higher IQ, but a highly developed nervous system becomes sensitive to minor kind of changes. Like, for example, a sunshiny, bright day, they're happy because this affects them. It's kind of a minor stimulus. A gray, gloomy, rainy day, and they're more depressed. They have highly developed nervous systems. They're sensitive to things in their environment. These are the people that if everybody smiles and says hello when they see them, they'll be happy. But if everybody kind of is cross and just walks past them without talking, they'll be depressed for the day. And this change in chemicals in their body every month, twice a month in fact, both at ovulation and at menstruation, almost especially, the psychiatrists and psychologists have pointed out, just premenstrually, it's even been called premenstrual tension. A woman is much less able to predict her emotional reaction to the situation, is much more apt to be irritable or depressed or just not aware of how she's going to be able to react. And it makes her feel emotionally somewhat unstable because at these times of the month, she just, there have been experiments that, and I told this to one of my classes and I really misspoke. And what I said is that the research shows that women who have been picked up by the police for every offense except prostitution, which is, and you people here, it sounded kind of like I said something that I didn't mean to say, that what has happened here is that it's been because of premenstrual tension for vandalism, for shoplifting. For all these offenses, studies have shown that these offenses occur just prior to menstruation, that somehow the woman isn't any more in control of herself. Assuming, you see, that this is a basically law-abiding woman. The prostitutes are basically not law-abiding women, and therefore you see that this doesn't hold true. So there is some empirical evidence that this is so, that a woman is emotionally less stable than man, and I think the whole symbolism is in these stories. That a woman is really dependent emotionally on man. A man is much more emotionally stable. I'm not saying that he's smarter, or that he can endure pain more, or that he has any other attributes. But he is able to be more emotionally stable. He is much more able to predict his reaction to situations day by day than a woman is. She is much more apt to be affected by these changes in chemicals in her body. And I think that's what the symbolism really says, that a woman is born from man, or that it's really saying that the man is the one here on which the woman is dependent. Kind of the, you see what I'm trying to drive at? That there is a sense in which man, at least emotionally, psychologically, is, I don't know, I suppose I was almost going to use the word superior, and I suppose that's what the myth says, you know, that the woman is dependent on him for life, she sprung from him. But I think that's one valid interpretation of these particular myths that are common in these cultures. Well, let me tell you about some of the other stories that have the same thing. I've mentioned already the story of Adam and Eve, and I wanted to just talk about this, and maybe then we'll have to quit. And we'll talk about some of these others tomorrow, and I'll try to wind up my thesis.
Rick,
yes.
Before you go to another story, about the basket that she's carrying, what do you see that
as? Well, I haven't really bothered with this. It'd be fun to think about it. What is the basket like? Do you remember? Can you describe it to me, what the story says? See, we'll work that out right now. Yeah? Okay, that makes it, that, it's funny how Freud always interprets these things sexually, but let me just tell you some of the things that he interprets. This basket, and here, what it is, it's a basket of goodies, and I can just imagine as an artist draws this, that it's adorned with flowers or has some kind of ornamentation on it, that it's not probably just a plain basket. I don't remember seeing this, but Freud would say this, that everything in dream symbolism that is box-shaped or coffin-shaped even or basket-shaped that contains something, whether it's a jewelry box, whether it's the gingerbread house with cookies and everything that the witch made for Hansel and Gretel, whether it's Pandora's box, you see in the story of Pandora, all of these things that are in a box-like or a basket-like shape that contain things that things go in and out of, especially valuable things like goodies or treasures. See, all this symbolizes really a woman's womb or entrance to the womb. That this is really how humanity really sees this as a kind of treasure box containing, you see. Well, I think the symbolism becomes more obvious if you realize this is what Freud says it is. That Pandora's box really that contains... we'll talk about Pandora's box tomorrow, or maybe today if we have time, and you'll see, I think, very clearly. Or maybe we'll talk about Hansel and Gretel, and you see the symbolism of the gingerbread house. It's really, it could very well be. See, here's Little Red Riding Hood carrying this box of goodies. Well, if a box of goodies symbolizes her sexual area, you see, it makes the story all the more plausible that this is Oedipal complex, especially when she meets a wolf in the woods with this, and then I think the symbolism here becomes fairly obvious. This is what is being symbolized. Though I haven't really bothered to think about that in any detail, that's what first strikes me as a dream interpretation.
Jerry, you know that.
A good worry, we'll think about it.
No, really, no.
You know that joke about the
cigar?
The psychiatrist who was showing all these ink blocks to the patient.
Yeah, go ahead.
Every time the patient would be soft sex, he'd give all these lurid sexual descriptions of what itself. And the psychiatrist, man, you've got the dirtiest mind I've ever seen. Will you keep showing me all those dirty pictures?
There was another situation that Ken was telling me about this last issue of Time, or 2 weeks ago, or whatever it was, where it was pointed out they were talking in Time about the symbolic nature of especially the Freudian psychologists, you know, how they interpret everything symbolic. If you wear a tie, see, a tie is a phallic symbol, and where you put your tie clasp or whether you wear a bow tie instead of this tells lots and lots about your attitude towards sexuality. And they talk about, you know, the colors you wear and the way you wear your hair, whether it's long or short or clean or dirty or combed or uncombed, all these things, that they tell something about your innermost nature. And one of the things that Freud had said is people that smoke pipes, this is really they were deprived of adequate thumb sucking when they were doing it. or see, there's a lot of this symbolism. And someone came to Freud one time who smoked an average of 12 cigars a day, and eventually got jaw cancer. This is what killed him, is jaw cancer. But someone came to him and said, "Now, do you know really what you're doing when you're smoking a cigar? What a cigar is a symbol of?" And Freud took a cigar out of his mouth and kind of tapped it and looked at the thing and he said, "Young man, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar." And then to me, he was saying, you know, the symbolism doesn't always apply. And that's the But it is true that a Freudian psychologist does look for symbolism in everything. A Freudian psychologist says absolutely everything you do is symbolic of your innermost nature and is determined by your unconscious mind. Regardless what it is, the littlest, tiniest thing. You know, and I could pick on myself, exactly the way I'm dressed is symbolic of something very deep about my nature, you know, that...
Yes.
See what Freud would say, this growing of a beard is an indication of an inadequate concept of my own male sexuality. What I'm doing is trying to prove to myself... See, just like the juvenile delinquent, research has shown that the majority of juvenile delinquents are really suffering from an inadequate sexual identity, that the female's most common kind of sexual misdemeanor is a sexual one, to kind of prove to herself how female she is, that the males always are having to do with what our culture considers masculine, aggression, competition, independence, and they have to do with these kind of things that are really trying to prove to themselves they're very masculine. That one of the kind of therapies for juvenile delinquents, the males, they try to prove to them that they are really masculine, and they don't have to prove it by stealing and being aggressive and being sexual with women and these kind of things. That this is the real see, and Freud's saying that's why a man grows a beard, that he feels an inadequacy. You know, I'm not saying that I go along with all of Freud's symbolism. You know? that if you have an inadequate concept about your masculinity, you're more likely to grow a beard to show, you know, here I really am masculine.
Wouldn't a great deal depend on the culture in which you are?
Well, I'm sure that's true. For instance, if there are no razor blades, for instance.
Yeah, but I mean, there was a time, my grandfather's time, when beards were quite common.
And that might be part of the reason. You know, I can just imagine shaving with these things that your grandfather must have shaved with. Because
yeah.
When King Gillette came along, was just 1890-something, wasn't it, when he established his first very primitive safety razor. But, you know, these others, boy, I'd be afraid.
Yeah, but the time of the Revolutionary War, men were all clean shaved. Or swing.
Seems to be that way. It seems to be that way, though. I can imagine the shaving facilities were quite poor. You know, the utensils they used must have been. You know, sure, steel was invented and it could be honed very sharply, but I still have suspicions about the kind of nicks and cuts and whatnot people were doing.
Well, I was going to say that when men wore beards, at that time, it wasn't much time for sexual enjoyment when you date, really.
I don't know if I want to pursue this or not. It doesn't strike me as being self-evident, though, at all. I mean, I don't see why you say that at all.
Well, I find that if I was living in that time, I find that I'd probably be going and tapping at the store of this big rooming house. If I was to date a girl that was working woman or, you know, lived in society as the type of girl I date now, and this lady would come in and she'd say, who do you wish to call for? And then she'd call up and say, you have a caller. And then she'd come down and I'd sign my name, my address, and I'd have to go through a whole mess of red tape before I'd be able to meet this girl. And then I'd take her out, and we'd probably have a chaperone. And then I'd take her back very early before dark.
Well, that may be true. I don't know.
Whereas now,
what are you wearing at? Well, just one indication that this isn't necessarily true for everybody. You see, the number of children per family, for instance, has decreased instead of gone up, which indicates that some people did have some time for some kind of relationship. Even though this is, you know, I'm talking. I don't know as if I really am speaking to the. You're talking really about dating rather than after marriage, I suppose.
Well, this is. I'm in this, you know, time right now, dating.
I just don't know. I don't know. Is there any historian here who knows how much time dating couples had for?
Can I ask a question? The thing that I see happening now, I do not know of having happened before, and that is the somewhat merging of the sexes in appearance. Now, I got used to not being able to tell the boys and girls from the back, but when I can't tell them from the front. I wonder if this is some, at least a fairly new phenomenon. I don't recall it in our recent.
Well, there's quite a few things that historically have been different about this. There was, for instance, historically one time when the male, just as in much of the animal kingdom, really wore the bright feathers and the bright colored clothes. Sir Walter Raleigh, for instance, with his robe that he could put on the pile for her.
Yeah.
I forget who it was.
African colors,
right.
That is still true.
And it seems
but
to be,
you could still tell the men from the
right.
Women.
And now what seems to be happening is that our culture is in a state of transition for several reasons. Not only is the man beginning to wear more brightly colored plumage, you know, the beads and the bright shirts and the long hair and things, which are in some ways, at least long hair is in some ways an indication of a certain kind of self-identity. That not only for Samson was it a sign of strength, but for women it's been a sign of beauty. And Freudians talk an awful lot about a person's hair. that there seems to be a transition for another reason too, that only the first time in this society, at least for a long, long time, a woman is asserting the role of equality in everything with man, so that she is not, her role no longer is to be in the home to rear the man's kids and take care of his house and do this kind of work, cook the meals for the family, but now she is his equal. And there's a change in the role in the sexes. The female now is being educated, not only being educated, but at many schools is getting grades superior to that of the male students around her, even in subjects like engineering, which have usually been pretty much strictly the prerogative of the male. And it causes, say, some psychologists, and Betty Friedan has written a book called The Feminine Mystique that explores this somewhat, and many other psychologists have looked at this in a slightly different way, that what has happened here is that the male is becoming insecure in his masculinity. That he really is, you see, when the woman wears the pants in the family, what is he, and she has all these jobs and she's being his equal. Does that take away from his role or not? Does it threaten the cultural tradition in this culture that a male is the superior, the head of the family, where the woman is the heart? And the woman, too, becomes somewhat threatened and insecure, according to Betty Friedan, you know, because she no longer has the male to rely on now for her, to depend on, to help her out. See, psychologists have said for a long time, and I'll just speak to this, we'll get into Adam and Eve next time. Maybe those of you who come next time would like to read the story of Adam and Eve first, and we'll explain the symbolism in it, and after you come next time. That what they've said is that in every area of life, a woman, maybe determined by her culture, but partly through this biology I talked about before, is really looking for emotional stability. For, in other words, what Kent called security. That this is really the dominant motivation of all women. See, in the fairy tales, it's the man that goes out and slays the dragon to rescue the female from him, because the female needs this security and the male needs this adventure. That the man is aggressive and independent, but the woman dependent and needing security. And they've talked about this, Freud, and I think he's right in many ways, and we'll talk about that next time too, and we'll get into Adam and Eve, has said that one of the big, that the thing you can tell the most about a person is the way he views sexuality. That sex is one of the only behaviors really that can either be entirely selfish or entirely unselfish, and there are many other things about it that make it very unique and therefore very important for human beings to discover how to react to it. And psychologists have pointed out that, and I've noticed this in my own counseling with students at St. Olaf, that the girls who are very sexually active in every instance, really, that I've been able to determine, have had a feeling of aloneness and isolation and insecurity that has made them, before marriage or out of a love relationship, have these sexual relations. But for the boys, there are many different reasons. Some males are motivated intensely by curiosity. What does a naked woman look like and feel like and act like? And it's an intense curiosity. Or the female might have this kind of curiosity, but her main motivation still is security, not to be so alone, so lonesome, so insecure. The males might look at this as an assertion of their masculinity. The more notches I cut on my belt for the women I've conquered, you see, the more masculine I am. And they'll talk about it in the dormitories. Boy, you know, I really did such and such with so-and-so and with so-and-so, and the girls get a real reputation this way because the boys are bragging about their exploits. But yet the most sexually active girls on campus, their roommate, or at least the girl in the room next door, are completely unaware of their sexual activities. They don't do this to prove their femininity, and they don't brag about it to the whole dormitory of girls. They keep it to themselves. But the male doesn't. See, he wants to prove his masculinity by doing this. The male also will be motivated much more than the female, at least in these kind of relationships, especially out of marriage, when in this culture there is a bit of fear and insecurity involved in the relationship itself for both parties. It seems to bother the female more. The male will do this lots more for just the physical sensations of sex. His genitals are more externally located and more easily, he's more quickly and easily aroused and led to climax. The male will be motivated much more for this intense sensation. Many females don't experience. I told some weeks, or just a few days ago, I forget now when it was, about a girl who was so, she had nine males, she had intercourse with nine men, and she was only a sophomore in college. And she related that that for her, sex had absolutely no physical real sensation. But the only thing it was is that after these men would finish with her, they would fall asleep together on the same bed, usually this happened in a motel or someplace where they could do this. And then she would get her real satisfaction. Here's a warm, live, breathing body right next to me, and it's so cozy. Gives me so much security, much more than my blanket or my stuffed dog or something, because because here he is. And see, what I'm saying is that I think that now what's happened is that a woman is also becoming insecure, and it's causing psychological troubles and probably male and female. They don't quite know where they fit in a lot of their, you know. But we can kind of continue this next time, and next time we'll start again with, we'll start with the story of Adam and Eve, and we'll go through some of these stories and what they say about bananas from the point of view of a dream symbolism.